Thanks everyone for coming along to this session. It's called the Market Panel Investment Forecasting. We've got four investment experts who will share with us big issues within the asset classes which they look at. 2025 has been an interesting year in markets. We've had a certain individual cause a lot of headlines in a lot of directions. A lot of things have moved more than they normally do. And I think it'll be interesting to hear what our different panelists have to say about their own views on markets today. Along with Jan Swinho, Actuary of the Year, who spoke this morning, and Aidan Nguyen as the guy who came up with the idea. We created a podcast earlier in the year called Investment Ideas. And the idea was to engage more people within the actuarial profession who have an interest in investing. And today is another initiative in that regard. So I got four people with me, all experts in their own fields with investment backgrounds. Alison Savas is an investment director at Antipodes and a member of the portfolio management team responsible for communicating market ideas, market views, investment updates, and portfolio positioning to clients and consultants and to the media. Before joining Antipodes, Alison worked at Smith Tan Asset Management and Kingfisher Investments in Singapore and at Platinum Asset Management. Following Alison, we'll have James Holiday-Smith, who's a portfolio manager at Macquarie Global Listed Real Estate Fund. James is a regional head for APAC, and he's responsible for investment decisions in the Global Fund, as well as managing a standalone Aussie-listed real estate fund. James will be investing in real estate securities for 15 years, with experience both here and in the US. Then we'll have Josh Manning, who is the founder and portfolio manager at Manning Asset Management, which he founded in 2015 to invest in fixed income and credit assets. He oversees and manages strategic asset allocation and portfolio construction and leads the firm, where he crafts and executes the firm's investment strategies to ensure the firm's sustained growth and success. He was previously with Jana Investment Advisors and Macquarie Bank. And finally, Julian McCormack, who joined Merlon in August of last year in the role of portfolio manager engagement. He assists with Merlon's engagement efforts with portfolio companies, communication with external shareholders, and investment analysis focused on commodities. Julian has previously worked at both Platinum Asset Management and Credit Suisse. So without further ado, Alison's going to come to the stage and share with you her big idea. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks, Douglas, as well. So before I start on my big idea, I just want to spend a few moments to talk you through how Antipodes goes about investing in global equities. So at Antipodes, we are a pragmatic value manager. So we are looking for companies that are mispriced relative to their business resilience and their growth profile. So at one end of the spectrum, we will own GDP plus light growers that are typically on low multiples, but they're market leaders and they're not under a threat of disruption. At the other end of the spectrum, we will own companies that are on optically higher multiples, but they're cheap relative to their growth profile and they're cheap relative to their peers. So you can see how we differ from a more traditional value manager. You know, the traditional approach is to wed to owning low multiple stocks with an expectation of mean reversion, so expecting that multiple to go higher. But what that can miss is change, and that's when a company is being outcompeted or worse, permanently impaired by the competition. And we don't want to own those businesses regardless of how cheap they become because they're the classic value trap. Now, if we think about the way the market has behaved, you know, really over the last 10 years, we've had a very quality-driven market. And this rally in quality stocks has led to extreme market cap concentration. So we got to the end of last year and the top 10 stocks in the S&P were just over 30% of the S&P by market cap. And you can see on the chart here just how extreme that is relative to history. Now, we also know that from looking at history that bubbles do ultimately unwind, and they do so because you get a change in leadership and the cycle moves on. And that's what we started to see at the beginning of this year, and it was really kick-started by the arrival of DeepSeek, but also Trump policies. And we think this rotation can continue. So the idea that I want to talk about today is how to capture value as markets broaden. And we think this broadening can really be driven by regional shifts from a change in fiscal impulse, and also sector and style shifts from an infrastructure-led investment cycle, and also the changes that are underway in AI. So if I start with that regional broadening, you know, when we think about the US, US exceptionalism has had both structural and cyclical forces behind it. So part of the reason why the US has been exceptional is just because they've spent so much more money than the rest of the world. And you can see that on the chart there, that the cumulative fiscal deficit in the US from 2016 to 2023 got to more than 50% of GDP. And, you know, if you compare that just to, say, to Europe there, you know, they spent more than twice that of Europe. Now, we need to normalise this exceptionalism for what has been an extraordinary amount of spending, because the US can't continue to spend at this pace because there'll be consequences to this. So in the US, we're looking at the starting point of being very loose fiscal policy to, at the margin, incrementally tighter. Now, on the other hand, China and Europe have been very weak because they've just spent a lot less money. But Trump's policies around defence, you know, indicating that he's going to pull defence support to Europe and these tariff and trade wars have really galvanised Europe and China into spending more money. And we know that the answer to cyclical weakness is fiscal stimulus. So in Europe and China, we're going from a starting point of conservative fiscal position to, at the margin, incrementally looser. And so that's what I'm talking about when I'm referring to that change in fiscal impulse. And it's not just, you know, Europe's 500 billion euro planned infrastructure program or lifting defence spending to 3% of GDP or China's consumption incentives. You know, we know that, and you can see on the slide there, that fiscal policy is loosening in other parts of the world. And that's going to lead to new winners. And as these investment programs or these, you know, these fiscal programs get underway, that can catalyse a change in sector preferences. So while the market, particularly in global equities over the last years, has been very narrowly focused on just a handful of stocks or a handful of companies, what it's missing is that there's a very broad-based investment cycle that's already underway, and it relates to the West's continued investment in onshoring, the energy transition or defence spending, and it also relates to AI. As our usage of AI increases, we are going to need more investment in infrastructure that is closer to the end user. So not just investment in these very large data centre clusters in the US or in China, but smaller clusters, smaller data centre clusters in Australia, in the Middle East, in other parts of Asia, or in Europe. And we're also going to need more, we're going to see a lot more investment in AI-enabled devices to bring AI to the application layer. So incorporating AI into wearables, or incorporating or getting a personal assistant in our own devices. Now, we're also finding opportunities in the democratisation of AI. So the arrival of DeepSeek is significant because it's widened the range of outcomes around AI. And DeepSeek isn't going to be the only new competitor. There's going to be many more. But the innovation that we're seeing in both hardware and software has reduced the cost to use models by 100 times over the last 12 months. Now, this, you know, significantly lower cost is driving usage, it's driving adoption, and that usage is going to continue increasing. So we see value in AI shifting away from the enablers and to the adopters. So away from just the hardware layer to the infrastructure and the application layer. So at Antipodes, we're looking for companies that are cloud native, that have large, well-organized data sets, because remember, data is the asset here, because it's these companies that are going to be able to easily incorporate AI into their business, and they're going to use it to cut costs, drive productivity, or enhance their own value proposition to their own customers, and they're going to charge for this. Now, these AI beneficiaries are going to be present in a whole host of sectors, and we're finding them, we're finding these beneficiaries in companies where the where it's not already being factored into consensus earnings or the valuation that you pay for these companies. So the point of all of that on the slide is to say that, you know, as these sector preferences shift, new winners will emerge. And so the days of US mega cap dominance, in our view, are definitely going to evolve. So to leave you with one stock idea before I pass over, we think Siemens, which is a German-listed industrial business, is a really good way to play these regional and sector shifts. It is a global leader in factory automation, in infrastructure, and also in rail. And we've liked Siemens for a while because it was very, it positioned itself very well very early on for the rise in the software age, long before its competitors did. So it's got this very integrated hardware and software offering, which it uses to optimize processes and efficiencies for its end markets. So to give you a few examples, it has, one of their key products is to produce a digital twin of a product that's going to get made in the real world. So it does this virtually. So what that does is it removes this endless prototyping that would typically happen in the real world. This now happens digitally. They have products which increase the energy efficiency of buildings. They have products that increase the efficiency of the rail network. So, you know, literally putting more trains on the existing train network to reduce emissions in the transport sector. And it's already incorporating AI into its business. So one of the recent examples was it used AI to help plan and develop a hydrogen plant. And by using AI, it cut the manual steps in half and reduced the timeline of that project from months to weeks. And this company, it's going to be a big beneficiary of those global CapEx cycles I mentioned. You know, factory automation is going to be very present as the West continues to onshore. It's a beneficiary from decarbonisation and energy transition. And it's also going to be a big winner as Europe continues to invest in its own infrastructure. Now, this company is growing around 10% per annum. It's priced at around 17 times, so it's significantly cheaper than its US-listed peers. So this is just one example that we found in a way to capture value as the markets continue to broaden. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Douglas, for inviting me, and thank you, everyone, for listening in today. So I thought you've probably been inundated with AI themes today. So as a real estate investor, I could have gone down that path and spoken about data centers and how important they're going to be for everything in the future. But given you've probably heard a lot already, I thought I'd do something a little bit different and go with another, I think, actuary-friendly topic of US senior housing. And the reason it's an actuary-friendly topic is because it's all about demographics. It's all about longevity risk, and it's all about a growing pool of comorbidities amongst the elderly. And we believe that US senior housing is one of the best placed listed real estate themes globally. And the reason why it is so well placed is because you are at the precipice of a demand acceleration, which is 80 years in the making. For reasons I'll go into, supply is going down to zero. Supply is typically the thing that kills a real estate cycle. And because we're at the early part of a cyclical upturn, you've got a cyclical upswing that's going to come from occupancy gains and margin improvement as they start to fill buildings up. But the product that we're talking about here, and there's some pictures on the right-hand side there, is in the US, in the listed market, is very much geared towards the affluent population. So on average, it costs $8,000 a month. Two-thirds of that cost is care, so that's paying for nurses and food and things like that. The other third is for accommodation. But given the REITs in the US tend to own some of the best properties, they will often be more expensive than that. And as you can see, that's a pretty beautiful building that's under development at the moment in Canada. So demographics. We are past the trough in births that resulted after the Great Depression. And what we saw after the conclusion of World War II was that births actually boomed again. And it is this 80-plus-year-old cohort who, born around 1940, 2020 today, are just starting to hit their strides and get to the point where the consumption of aged care really starts to accelerate. The growth in that population cohort is really starting to move meaningfully. So as we see in the chart in the middle, the growth rate is about to accelerate from sort of 2% per annum up to 6% per annum, and it's going to stay above 4% for a number of years. In addition to there being a growing pool of potential customers, these customers are increasingly wealthy. In real terms, the wealth or net worth of an 80-plus individual has increased over three times over the last 25 years, and they have really benefited from the growing financialization of the economy. House prices, equity prices are all at sort of all-time highs as you think about them in terms of a price-to-multiple, price-to-earnings perspective. And as I mentioned earlier, the thing that always kills a real estate cycle is supply. What is really unusual about senior housing at the moment is that your supply, so the number of new starts that developers have committed to, is effectively going down to zero. And it's at close to the lowest it's ever been in recent history. And the reason why construction starts are falling is because your replacement cost is really elevated. The cost of materials and labor is going up. And the rent that you can charge would not currently provide you with an economic return on what it costs you to build. So number one, too expensive to build them. Number two, you could go out in the market and buy an asset for 70 cents on the dollar versus what it costs you to build one. So why would you build a new property? So what that means is that your installed base is not growing. At a time where your potential customers, the demand growth is about to accelerate and remain elevated for a number of periods. And what we call that in real estate land is absorption, which is the number of sort of, or the amount of supply that's taken out of a market in a given year. And absorption is currently running at two times its normal level and is probably going to go even higher. If supply is growing at zero, demand is growing at six, you'd expect your absorption to go to about 6%. Now, why that's important to us is because not only are we at a sort of cyclical trough from a supply perspective, but we're also coming out of a cyclical trough after COVID. So with COVID, there was an elevated number of deaths. Your average length of stay in a senior housing facility is 2 years. So people go there when they're very frail. They don't stay very long. You churn through your population quite quickly. There were elevated deaths through COVID. But as well as that, it was oftentimes very difficult to move in new residents because there might have been lockdowns in place or facilities were shut because maybe there was a COVID outbreak. So what we saw was occupancy fell across the industry. We're now 4 years into the rebound and occupancy is starting to rebuild, but it's only up to 86%. The previous high in the industry was 92%. And with the outlook for both supply and demand, it is completely plausible to expect that occupancy will go above the prior peak level. Now, with occupancy depressed, your margins are also down because even though you may not have all your rooms or beds full, you oftentimes have to have all your staff on at the facility level, which means that you're paying for more labor without having a full revenue role coming in the door. So as your occupancy comes on, your margins are going to improve. Your incremental margin from higher occupancy levels is almost 100 cents in the dollar. So while portfolio margins are at sort of 26%, if we go and dig down to specific asset level, the assets can run with a margin up to 40%. So what the real opportunity here is as these facilities fill up, the margin profile is going to improve meaningfully and profitability is going to improve meaningfully. Now, with the setup that markets have ahead of them, the listed market has sort of predictably priced in a lot of that growth up front. And while it looks expensive 1 year out, where the real opportunity is that as you look out multiple years, the amount of growth that can continue to fill in as a result of demographics, which is somewhat immutable, there is a long-term potential of double-digit returns for the next sort of 5 years plus. And I'll leave with that. Thank you very much.
So today I'd like to talk to you about a very famous South African golfer. Now, for those of you who don't know your South African sports history or your golfing history, this is the great Ernie Els, or as many like to call him, the Big Easy. Now, if Ernie Els was an investment, he is every fund manager's dream. See, as a fund manager, you make more money as you get more assets under management through base and performance fees. The challenge is, though, as you get bigger or you are large, you have more investments to manage, and that takes up a certain bandwidth in portfolio managers and investment teams. So the simple answer to that is as you get bigger, and this is very much a credit sort of lens I'm putting on this in our asset class, the bigger you get, the you want to do fewer, larger transactions. And what I would argue is in today's environment, what we're seeing now is there's disproportionately more capital chasing these larger transactions than their smaller equivalents. Now, so that sort of addresses the big. Now, the easy, well, there's nothing easier than investing in credit through listed markets. So in those listed markets, you're competing against super funds, self-directed investors, brokers, international investors and alike. as a fund manager as well, when faced with two competing assets, one in a very easy to access listed form and another in a harder to find due diligence, execute and transact on, it's pretty clear that the former will be preferred. So while the big easy transactions are great for fund managers, they're not necessarily great for the underlying investors. See, some of these deals in a bid to purchase these assets borrow returns from the future. That is, they have their values inflated due to the excessive capital chasing those returns in order to secure their winning bid. So the big easy deals that all investors can pursue offer, particularly in today's environment, inferior risk-adjusted forward-looking returns versus smaller, harder-to-find equivalents. So what are today's big easy investments in credit? So this slide here is a lot of information. On the right-hand side, it shows the annual public securitization issuance, so the issuance of asset-backed securities in the Australian market over the prior 6 years. And what you can see is in last year, there was $80 billion of these assets being issued, which is the highest ever. This year is slightly less than that, but still shaping up to be a very strong year. And on the left-hand side, this is the credit spreads on the relevant credit-rated notes within these structures, from a senior AAA right down to a single B. So these are floating rate margins, so they'll not benefit from the RBA cash rate moving up or down. It's purely the credit spread margin on there from the blue down the bottom. That's obviously your highest rate note up. Now, I've just highlighted the little pluses there, which might be hard to see, but they are the lowest rated investment grade note in these transactions, which is a triple B. And what we've seen is historically those spreads, those credit spreads, have been around the 400 to 600, but typically averaging around the 400 basis points over margin. Today's environment, they're around 200. Now, the investors in those instruments will be sitting there saying, great, I've had an excellent return from this credit asset. I've written down the credit profile. So as credit spreads compress, the face value of the bond goes up, leading to outsized returns. But what they're not realizing, or what the market isn't as aware of, is the actual forward-looking returns are far depressed and there isn't that same sort of credit spread compression upside available. So that's one example of the big easy. These are big transactions, very easy to get your hands on. The next, I think, is very large credit transactions in the Australian market. We see the pricing on $75 million plus type parcels of assets being somewhat lower than some of the smaller equivalents. And we just argue that there are so many global investors in the Australian market right now from Asia, from the US, the big credit funds and alike, chasing these assets, that those returns are just simply lower than some of the smaller equivalents. And in my view, this is somewhat controversial. The other big easy is the feed of funds into offshore fund management credit portfolios. So Australian feed of funds, significant fee leakage, which just equals, in my view, inferior risk-adjusted returns going forward. So how do you spot the big easy and how do you avoid them? Well, I think when you look at particularly credit or any asset class, it's just a matter of understanding the aggregate capital flows, so inflows into the asset class less outflows, against the growth rate in that asset class. So taking this example, being significant growth in the asset class, but still credit spreads are compressed. So there's more capital coming into this space than there is growth in the underlying assets that are being originated. The next step is to understand where that capital is going to sectors. So if you look at the easiest to reach parts of these markets, so listed or more mainstream larger assets, and understand where those capital flows have distorted those valuations versus some of the more harder to reach equivalents. Once you understand capital flows, you can assess the valuation in light of this, that is still if those valuations coming into this asset, buying these assets, is artificially inflated or reflects true fair value. in credit. This is simply done by assessing credit spreads versus long-term averages and adjusting for underlying collateral and structural considerations. So my big investment idea isn't to be contrarian, rather seek out investments and managers that are not chasing the big easy dream. So that's managers that don't play by the same rules as everyone else. That means they may not be as benchmark aware, or they have the freedom in their mandate to find relative value, particularly in harder to reach segments. And ensuring that investment has alignment, either in terms of how the manager is financially rewarded, if they're staff owned, how much personal wealth they have in that strategy, and if they invest on the same terms. So in summary, in the investment world, avoid the big easies. Find investments where capital flows haven't distorted valuations to realise superior investment outcomes.
All right. So as I was designing this last night, I didn't think of it, but I want you to have a mental image in your mind of Oliver Twist approaching, and Oliver Twist is your hapless Australian equities manager, approaching the master of the workhouse saying, please, can I have my capital? Please, please. That's investing in Aussie equities. It's fun. By dint of history, geography, and population size, Australia has unbelievably concentrated markets in terms of industrial concentration. This is the kind of stuff you tend to see in the Philippines or Indonesia or Africa or parts of Latin America, where you get a concession to run a retail outlet or a, you know, it's a concession-based model. And so you end up with these oligopolies. Australia is characterized by these, and you would expect to see these being relatively high margin, somewhat slow growing, not amenable to doing value accretive acquisitions, certainly not in your domestic market. And, you know, that's sort of what you could expect from Australia. Let's have a quick trot through what we look like in terms of the numbers. So we're pretty expensive. This is just next 12 months price earnings ratio. The three on top, the US, then us, then rest of the world. We're paying a lot for these assets in Australia. Like, and that's not sectorally adjusted or whatever, right? So we've got banks and resources over the half the market. This stuff is getting pretty ritzy in terms of valuation. But maybe it's growing really fast. Nope. It's pretty mediocre. This is next 12 months earnings growth per share by market. Australia's like not great. You know, adjusted for population, it's probably not doing very well at all. So earnings growth isn't very good. We're paying a lot for it. But we pay big dividends, right? That's awesome. No, we don't. We're middle of the pack now, right? That's also a function of valuation. You know, you guys know how that works. But we are not very generative of dividends anymore. We're really middle of the pack. This is also very, very misleading in terms of total shareholder return, because we are very skewed to dividend return in this market because of our tax system, you know, imputation and franking credits, right? So we don't do nearly the buybacks of other markets, in particular Japan and certainly the US. So, you know, that's pretty mediocre. And we pay out a lot. That's, in a way, that's good, right? Like, so of every dollar earned, we're paying out about 60 cents in dividend. And that's pretty good in as far as it goes, right? So you might be saying, well, hang on, what are you carrying on about with the Oliver Twist thing? Like, they're giving you all the capital they're generating. Here's the problem. For every dollar Aussie corporates say they're earning on the P&L, they are actually earning about 60 cents in operating cash, which is frankly appalling. Now, word of caution, this is an index level measure from Bloomberg, and I don't have a long series. It's incredibly labor intensive to generate that, but that's a future work program. We'll see if there's a pattern over time. It doesn't surprise us at all. This is actually a huge focus of our investing, is to avoid this kind of behavior. Now, how does this, and like, when I say that, you might say, well, it's because of our resources companies, so therefore they're spending a lot of capital. It's like, look at Canada, look at Brazil. Like, no, this is a problem of corporate governance, we would suggest. So where does the cash all go? This is an excerpt of a letter that we have written to a portfolio company. And it's just seeking to summarize what we mean when we say lack of cash conversion. EBITDA is the P&L measure, and then gross operating cash flow is how we think about the world. Gross operating cash flow leakage for this company is somewhere between 100 and 50%. So for every dollar you say you're earning on the P&L, you're actually generating 0 to 50 cents in cash. It's leaking out in a whole bunch of ways. There's an inventory. This is a fuel retailer. There's an inventory impact in the early part of this decade, going back to the right-hand side of the series. That never unwinds though. So that's kind of a problem. So where did all that go? Just gone. Hey presto. So we have this awful leakage of capital in this system between accounting earnings and cash earnings. And that's not a good feature of this system and one that's not very commented on. It's largely born of boards being really bad, right? So the other title for this series could be Be Less Shit. Like, this is terrible corporate behavior, like, not to put too fine a point on it. And we have a really clubby little atmosphere in this country where we have multiple board members all remunerated in the same pool, all like participating in the same behavior. So we're accruing heaps of stuff that should be written off. Every mining company is saying they're doing overburden in advance ahead of, you know, their strip ratio, but then it never reverses back out. So where did all that go? It just disappears. We're saying that we're doing maintenance in our cash flow that is not being expensed in our earnings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is corporate governance stuff. It's not a like magical occurrence. This is choices being made. But then the other thing too is these very, very consolidated, uncompetitive players do stupid deals. So of the seven really consolidated industries in this market, four, and this is just sitting around at 8 o'clock last night, just, you know, thinking on the top of my head, like, we're buying dumb stuff and we're lying about our earnings, but apart from that, it's going really well. Right. So like, what can we do about that? That's all very negative. I get that. And I am being flippant. It's sort of my nature. What can we do about all that? Well, we have to actually engage with corporates, right? So we actually have to change their behavior. So it is not sufficient for us to sit around and passively participate in markets and say, yes, that's fine. Just generate 60 cents of earnings for every dollar you say. That's not good enough. And also, we do have a retirement savings problem in this country. We're better placed than most, but we ain't out of the woods yet. So we actually do need these businesses not to destroy capital for us. So, you know, that's my cheery little talk for you. And now I'll sit down. Thanks.
Thanks, Julian. Always good to have a cheerful note to end on. Now, I'd just like to invite the panel to come up to the high chairs for the Q&A session. We've got about 10 minutes left, so we'll get to talk more about Oliver Twist and Ernie Els and a few of the other topics that we've had so far. So if you do have any questions, please do send them through and I'll read them out. I always think it's interesting just first to ask, you've all got different backgrounds and different expertise. Maybe just quickly, sort of from left to right, one thing you took away from the other presentations that either surprised you or challenged your thinking. Maybe, James, if you want to just go first there.
I'm actually shocked at how bad the cash flow conversion is in Australia. And when you sort of think about it that way, like, we are a quality focused manager, and our belief is that growing free cash flow per share is really what drives value. So your ability to convert sort of operating earnings into cash flow per share, like, that's the crux of it. And I look at sort of some of the investment opportunities that we have globally, and yes, they look rich, but if you're comparing them to a PE multiple of an Australian company and half the E's fictitious, then maybe they're not as rich as I thought they were.
Oh, good. Well, it was cheerful after all. Alison, any jump out for you?
Well, in terms of, as you know, what I do all day is look at global equity. So I actually found listening to the credit piece quite interesting, because when we're analysing companies, we forget that, there is a whole debt piece that actually needs to be considered. And it was actually quite surprising to me just to see how tight credit spreads had become. And I know that's in the Aussie market, but I would say, I would assume that's broadly true globally. So that was actually quite a shock to me as well. So that was my thing.
Cool. Thanks. Josh?
I think probably the thing that came out for me was just how specialized all the relevant asset classes are. Like listening to the presentation, there's far more skill than I could possibly add to these types of investment propositions. So I think it just reinforces the need for deep specialists and being in the trenches, sort of engaging with underlying companies is absolutely part of our bilateral negotiations. And I think just really highlighted that that isn't a credit specific requirement.
Excellent. Thanks. Jules?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I was surprised, but I was enticed by aged care housing. That sounded great. I'm going to get out of here and get some of that.
Thanks. I was thinking the same, actually. That's good. Okay, thanks. Well, Julian, there is a question that's come through for you, which says, is this a problem with our assurance and audit industry in Australia too? What about liquidity risk management standards? Do you have any views on that?
Look, it's clearly a feature of the system. So, you know, I've been involved in an audit or two, you know, in various capacities, and I have not found them very exacting. So, yeah, like that is a problem. The issue, though, I think is this is born of complacency, right? So the thing I didn't mention is we haven't had a real recession for 30 years. Like, so no one's really been tested. You know, corporate indebtedness is sort of middle of the road by global standards, and government indebtedness is middle of the road by, you know, so it's almost like the sort of banality of evil. It just creeps up on you over time. And it's not like this is any sort of crisis. It's just this very gradual erosion of value over time.
Yeah. Cool. Josh, you interact with a lot of corporates in the local market. Do you have anything to add on that? On the sort of quality or the audit, the assurance that when
we speak for a very small part of the market. So we're really financing lenders that are anywhere between $50 to sort of $400 million. So we're not doing the mega caps. Yeah. In that space, we have a whole bunch of standards. The audit process, there can be a little bit of finger in the air, which is where we like to get involved. But I think that is part of the challenge of that. So I don't know if corporate standards are wanting from what we see, but we don't see sort of uniformity like you would ideally like. But that might be by nature the sort of the size of the market that we're participating in.
Cool. Thanks. Maybe Alison, you might want to take this one. Someone's asking if the equity market's become disconnected from fundamentals and more driven by flows, maybe Aussie-specific around super funds, but more broadly across the world, people having mandates to allocate to equities and the total investment universe isn't growing proportionately. Do you think that provides any effective floor for the market and it may avoid us seeing large 40 to 50% drawdowns in future?
I would actually say that if I can speak to global equities, because that is sort of more my area of knowledge, I think the rise in passive has had a significant impact on the market. Because if you think about, you know, what are passive flows, you know, you're buying things that are already working, you know, so that's sort of driving what is already working higher and higher and higher, because as you're buying the index, you're just buying more of what's working. And we've really seen this, you know, build over the last several years. And the you know, if we think, well, if markets start, that's fine on the way up. but what happens on the way down? You know, on the way down, as these things, you know, as these big, you know, highly concentrated, when, you know, you saw the chart I showed, when the big caps start to fall, you know, they need to be sold. Like in the same way that they're bought on the way up, they get sold on the way down. And so this can unwind, I think, far more sharply than perhaps what we've experienced in drawdowns in the past. So I'd say the it's been that introduction of passive flows that's been quite significant, particularly in global markets. But I think, Doug, the earlier part of the question was, is fundamentals become a bit disconnected to I would also say, when we were chatting about the panelists, we were chatting about that this earlier before the session started, and we were saying how, you know, markets are at all-time highs. Well, they're back, global equities are now back at all-time highs, and there's sort of this, you know, the word I think you used was complacency. You know, the markets have become very complacent, and we would say that, you know, there's lots of risks bubbling under the surface. And I wouldn't necessarily say that there is one big gigantic red flag that we're looking out for, but You know, the things that we're observing are you've got an enormous amount of policy risk in the US. We have a highly unpredictable government. Geopolitical tensions are rising. You know, we're looking at some of the data in the US still looks okay, but we're at sort of above average levels of wage growth, which can easily sort of fall. Saving rates have collapsed. And so if we do get some kind of a slowdown, all that excess savings that have been built up, you know, they're gone now. And the US is a consumption-driven economy. So there's these little risks bubbling away, but the market is completely ignoring them. And so, and when you look at US equities and they're priced at 22 times earnings, they're priced for a very benign outcome. So I would say that, is there a disconnect? Well, we certainly think that in global equities, in certain pockets of it, particularly the US, they are factoring in a best case scenario.
James, probably the only cheerful person here from what I can gather. So let's talk about old people and cheer ourselves up, shall we? It was mentioned that the focus on senior homes investment in the US has been driven by the post-war demographic boom and the tightness in equity and real estate. You obviously look at the APAC region as well. Is there any sort of read acrosses, any similar trends in Asian markets? And if not, why not?
The demographics are certainly the same between the US and Australia and New Zealand and even many of the Asian countries. The main differences are really probably twofold. Number one, cultural. Eastern cultures much prefer to have a mixed household and they will look after their elderly. Us Western cultures, we turf them out. But the other difference is really a difference in funding structure. So there have been listed aged care plays in Australia, but I'm not sure if anyone's come across the sort of the intricacies of bonded care. So you pay a lump sum up front and then you hopefully get it back when you move out. But the consumer experience with these sort of bonded aged care plays has been really terrible because oftentimes it's a bit of a lobster pot. You can get in, but then takes you forever to get your money back. And you're trying to grapple over cents and dollars at a time when you're sort of going through grief and it leaves a really bad taste in the customer's mouth. And you contrast that to the US model, which is a developer will front up the cash, they'll maintain ownership of the asset, and it's really an occupancy times rent model. So they're trying to make their money through running the asset really well rather than trying to build it and then get people to sort of buy it off them and then they wash their hands of it.
Okay, cool. That's great. Thank you. Well, there's no further questions. I know we're going to get the bell called on us in about 50 seconds or so. So if anyone has any final comments before we wrap up, you want to make? And if not, look, thank you to everyone for coming. I think I think Josh, you summarized it quite well, just the idea that, you know, we have a collection of experts here who all probably know more about their segments than anyone could think about sort of collectively. And it's just that great opportunity to hear some of the insights from people, what they're seeing, what they think is important. And I hope every one of you has learned a few things today that you can take away. So thank you all for coming. And thank you to the panelists for their time. Thank you.